97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
How about old Fred Bottenheimer over there, ladies and gentlemen?
Yeah, it's a lonely studio, but I have Fred here. Sue's not here. She's off for a few days. But the Hall of Famer's with me here this afternoon.
Yeah, no pressure.
Have you been, I kind of feel guilty because you know how big of a Cardinals fan I am. Have you been staying up for these games?
I have been because it's exciting because you don't know what the young guys are going to do.
Can I tell you something without trying to stroke Ethan's ego because he knows this? So, you know, we have this text string with Scott Jennings and Joe Arnold and I, and mainly it's a baseball string because we're all huge Cardinals fans. So the first text that I get this morning is Jennings with a tweet that he shares that says, final thought of the night, what this STL Cards team continues to prove to fans is unbelievably impressive. The determination this team plays with alone is reason to be excited for the future. Their rotation includes 2.5 major league pitchers currently. Their lineup has holes left and right and goes on. It's Ethan. It's Ethan's tweet that Jennings is sharing with me. So I thought that was pretty cool. I had to stroke his ego a little
That's
bit.
That's great.
This morning. Pretty sad day at the Reardon household. Fred, I don't know if you heard me reference this, but I had to take Smokey in this morning to get his manhood taken away. Yeah, he's in the recovery room right now at Hope Animal Hospital in Fenton, and he has a couple of body parts that weren't there this morning that are missing, unfortunately. But he has been, you know, people ask me, even my own mother asked me, why did you get Oreo neutered? You know, because we got him neutered. Well, it does take some of the aggression away, right? So he's all kitten right now, and he's wrestling with the other cats, and the other cats get a little, you know, pissed off at times. But the neuter is done for a couple of different reasons. You don't want to have any more cats. We've got enough cats, right? It's part of the adoption process, but also because it's just better for him moving forward, or he's going to be a little bit too crazy. It's unfortunate what, you know, I had these awesome neighbors when we first moved into my house, and they loved cats and their heart was in the right place, but they let too many babies happen in the backyard, Fred. I mean, I think you remember me talking about this. Now, they did the right thing. They actually, before they moved, they had these two adult cats that, I mean, they were having a lot of litters. And at one point, this is a true story, at one point, it was entertaining because we could see all these kittens in the backyard and on their deck. And there was one point where the kittens were probably only 5 or 6 months, and it looked like they were playing until I looked closer, and they weren't playing. It looked like they were doing something a little friskier than playing. Oh. So I Googled this, and it says, yes, kittens can have kittens, which you don't want to have happen. Yeah, believe it or not, you don't have to be too old. So it's like a teenager, I guess, getting someone pregnant. Anyway, the point of the story is, in the end, my neighbor had the adult cats. Well, he had them all trapped, right? It cost him like $1,200 or something like that. They all were fixed then, brought to the vet, but he did the right thing because, you know, the feral cat thing can get out of control. So that's my Smokey story for today. He's in the recovery room. I have to do the $500 toothbrush story because I don't want to skip over that. Yeah. And I promised it for a couple of days, but I have a couple other things I wanted to get to here. But let's do this just because I find this fascinating. Do you have, I think I asked Sue this question and she said no. Do you have any Dyson products?
My wife does.
Yeah, I have two Dyson vacuum cleaners. So I have like a regular vacuum cleaner, and then I have one of the sticks that doesn't have a cord. It's battery operated. I love Dyson products, and I have for a long time, right? So this was a story that was just from the other day in the Wall Street Journal. It says, James Dyson sold us on a $400 hair dryer. I actually don't remember that, Fred. Now he's trying a $499 toothbrush. So it's a little clickbait there in the headline, but the details here are really interesting. And it says in the story, and I always heap praise on the Journal because I really like their reporting. They do a good job with technology and everything else. So it says, the inventor James Dyson has a winery, a knighthood, an English country pile, and an estimated net worth of more than $15 billion. He also, and this is where it's relatable for me because I hate the dentist, Fred. I think do too, right?
Do too.
So it says he also has a sense of dread when it comes to trips to the dentist's office. Although I'm quite a religious flosser, she always gets out the pickaxe and starts hacking away bits of hardened plaque. I've had to undergo the pickaxe every time I go to the hygienist and I get ticked off. And he's talking about the metal scraper thing. But this guy's 79 years old now, and he has spent 6 years inventing an AI-powered toothbrush that promises, Fred, to floss teeth at the same time it's brushing them, okay? This is the Dyson Camera Jet Toothbrush. It was unveiled on Tuesday. It is the very first foray into oral care for Dyson's company, known for harnessing, as they say in the story, the power of air, be it in a vacuum cleaner, a hairdryer, or a purifier. So he's had to do this, and he's worked on it for a long time. He says the engineers had to manipulate liquid. They developed a pump mechanism and a gravity-free tank that works no matter the angle of the brush to control the flow. The brush head features a tiny camera that analyzes 28 live images a second. This is nuts, right?
So that's where the AI comes
in? Yeah. To identify gaps in the teeth, triggering a conical burst of mouth rinse that flosses in between. Dyson had not worked with water since he co-designed a high-speed landing craft, which was called the Rotork Sea Truck, as a student at London's Royal Art College. He goes, this is something completely new, but why not? So it arrived in pink and blue colors. It's going to be available right now at Sephora stores. That's where my daughter goes, unfortunately. Best Buy. And on Amazon in September, in Costco later in the fall. So he's trying to convince people to swap out their analog toothbrushes and dental floss for a $499 machine, as well as special non-foaming Dyson toothpaste. The overall market for oral care, though, they say, is large, it's saturated, it's dominated by a handful of companies, and it's only expected to grow at a moderate rate. So he's going out there with a risk here on this thing. But the story overall is fascinating because it kind of goes into his history. And all these guys that have big companies that are billionaires, their backstories are fascinating, right? He had, by the time he married and had children, he was obsessed with the suction of vacuum cleaners. And in his early 30s, he didn't want to have a boss, right? I think we can all relate with that. He got a bank loan. He went into debt, cycling through more than 5,000 prototypes in his quest to perfect the bagless system that he eventually rolled out. His mentor, the designer Jeremy Fry, initially invested in the business. Dyson, though, later bought him out, 49% stake, and he's held 100% control ever since. Last year, the company generated $8.3 billion in revenue, which I think is incredible. So I do love their vacuum cleaners. And here's what I would say, because I'm someone who is facing, and I'm not even making this up, I'm facing $19,000 in dental work. Now, part of that figure, a large portion of that figure, is because it would be sedation dentistry, because I can't do it. I'm just telling you. I've tried to take a Xanax, go into the dentist, and you know, I could do a cleaning and some stuff like that, but I need some pretty serious work done. And the estimate at this point is really, really high. What they did, and I don't follow the instructions, Fred, I think I told you this. The dentist said, okay, let's start with, do you have like one of those water picks? And my daughter had one because of her situation with braces, right? So he also gave me toothpaste that you're supposed to use that you don't rinse out. Like it stays on your, how many times do you think I've used that toothpaste in the last 7 weeks?
Once?
Never. Because I don't do what I'm told. So the dentist, Dr. Spolito, great dude, smart, right? I like him. He's my daughter's dentist too. He tells me what to do. I completely ignore his advice, which probably leads me to $22,000 in dental work before we're all over because I'm just so bad at following directions. Now, having said that, here's what's interesting. Do you have an electric toothbrush?
No, okay. My wife does. I do not.
All right. So, Fred, I never had, and Dennis had told me for years, get an electric toothbrush, right? Never had one until probably 4 years ago. It's literally one of those situations, again, where I'm like, why didn't I have one of these to begin with? Because they're so good. So I'm sold on the electric toothbrush. I have a little recharging thing, you know, in my bathroom. So that, I think, is a smart thing to do. But I'm not good at some of the oral care. I think even though the price tag on this is a lot, maybe it comes down, I can see dentists recommending this thing, right?
You know, my fear of the dentist is so strong that A, I'm afraid of the electric toothbrush. I think it's going to be too hard. It'll knock my teeth right out. But that's probably not going to happen. But I wouldn't rule out, you know, a toothbrush that actually does the flossing if it does it, you know, in a unique way.
Yeah, if this guy's coming up with this now and he spent all these years,
it'll come down, and
more technology will happen. But the part that fascinated me in that story is the 28 live images, right? That's the, like you said, that's the AI portion of this. And that's nuts. I'm actually kind of surprised it's not more than $499.
Yeah, you're right.
So we'll see if they have sales of that. All right, I want to use this. I kind of want to use this as audio cut of the day. So I'm going to play it right now. And by the way, the Lindsey Clancy jury, after a very, very interesting day, went home. they're not sequestered even for deliberations. Phil Holloway is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. There are a lot of developments in that, very subtle, if you will, and we'll get to that at the bottom of the hour. But Ryan Reynolds said something on a red carpet, Fred, that has gotten people's attention. You haven't heard this yet, right?
No.
So I can't wait to get your reaction to this. So he's promoting, and I'm watching a show on Apple TV Plus right now that is called Tehran, which has three seasons. Pretty good, actually. I would recommend it. But when you watch any shows, usually on Max or Netflix, they'll roll a trailer for, you know, upcoming shows. So they've been pushing his show that he's in here that is called Mayday. And there's actually, I can't even believe that this happened, but there is a headline in Variety Magazine, you know, one of the trade publications, did a story on Ryan Reynolds because he actually said something about how horrific the 80s were. Now, he was trying to make a point that this movie has some, you know, maybe some influences and some inspiration from some movies like... I forgot what he mentioned, but even the Mel Gibson movies. I'll get to that in a second, because what he said about the 80s is what I want to focus in on here. So the movie Mayday is set in 1987. He plays a guy named Troy Kelly, who's a naval pilot nicknamed Assassin. So he's on the red carpet, and he's doing interviews about this movie, and he basically says that we have too much popular nostalgia, like you and I, people that grew up in the 80s, were too nostalgic about the 80s when it was a horrible, terrible, scary decade, okay? And if you don't believe me, just listen to what he said here, because it's kind of unbelievable. If I can get it to play.
What's interesting about when you get far enough away from a time period that's quite distinct, I think there's always a lovely feeling associated with it. It's almost like you pave over all the trauma with like puppy dogs and ice cream. And the 80s was a brutal, brutal time for people. It was
What? The 80s was like the best ever. Yeah. First of all, he's like 4 years old, and I think he was born in the mid or late 80s, so he didn't really experience the 80s. But his perspective on the 1980s, which, ladies and gentlemen, if you weren't around, I have to tell Ethan and some of the younger people, it was a glorious decade from a variety of perspectives. But
yeah, music.
Oh, everything. Fred, sports, listen, everything. Prince, Michael Jackson, think of all the things that came out of the 80s. John Hughes movies, all these things. Ronald Reagan, a renewed, you know, love of the country, which we didn't have post-Vietnam. But he goes on, he makes some interesting references here.
Mess. Like, you know, people forget that it was like, that was a tremendous strife.
No.
Sociopolitical tensions everywhere.
No, no.
You know, we're still like pretty fresh off like a Cuban Missile Crisis.
No, we weren't.
Which only like, what, 15, 20 years before.
No, it was
so,
a long time before.
You know, it's a tumultuous period. But
nope.
You look back at it now and you're like, oh yeah. Top Gun, cocaine. Like, no, it was like really scary. So I think, you know, I think when you look back at 2026 and this era, I think they're going to like pick on the big ticket items that don't really, didn't really leave the footprint culturally that you would think it would. Like, I don't know, so much of the aughts were like a mix of all the decades previous, whereas the decades previous were their own thing. So I don't know. I wonder what it's going to be. It's going to be like the COVID era. Or something. I have no idea.
No, you're probably right. It'll be rose-colored glasses.
Of course. We are living in the friggin' salad days right now.
I have nothing against Ryan Reynolds, by the way. I kind of like him as an actor, and I've never interviewed him before. I will say this. I know and I've experienced many times, the awkwardness of trying to handle a question that might be just a little different, and maybe he just misspoke. But my goodness,
yeah.
What he said about the 80s has no relation to reality whatsoever, and he's being mercilessly mocked for today on social media.
You know, I have trouble distinguishing between the decades most recently, but the 60s, 70s, and 80s all stand out uniquely.
Probably because of our age, but I would agree with you. And yeah, you know what? We should remember this as the COVID era because of all the nonsense that happened over the last few years. We should also remember this as the era where we had a president that was sleeping in the Oval Office for most of his term.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Does the president have any comment?
We're not going to comment.
It's not clear messaging.
No. And now, Sue's News. Brought to you by Sue.
All right, Ethan, I'll let you off a little easy today because
okay.
I didn't give you a lot of time. That's on me. By the way, did you hear that noise when I opened Sue's mic accidentally and I could hear that? Brad's in here trying to figure some stuff out. Yeah, that's a noise we don't like. It's actually better that Sue's not here. She would not be happy.
Uh-huh. That's what we've been dealing with. It is a very annoying noise, and yeah. I had to move spots earlier.
Did you hear it, Fred?
No.
Here, listen. Ready? Here we go. If you can't hear
nothing on
oh my
mind.
God. Okay, that means you can't hear, Fred. You can't hear high-pitched stuff.
Yeah, I don't know how
you could
hear
it, right?
That's crazy. I don't know how you couldn't hear that.
I can't believe
you
can't hear
that. I just failed my hearing
you
test.
You did fail your hearing test. That's amazing to me. Okay, anyway, let's do Ethan's news.
Happy National Baby Back Ribs Day.
Oh,
you guys
yeah.
baby back ribs, people?
Not really at the Fridays. Is that what you're talking about?
Uh-huh. No, it's yeah. The one I,
see,
always
I got the wrong chain.
Was
Chili's.
Chili's. Yeah, I want my baby back.
Yeah,
baby
right,
back,
right.
Baby back. Ribs are good. They're a lot of work, though.
Mm-hmm. My dad has gotten very good at preparing ribs.
Smoking
so,
stuff?
Shout out yeah. to Todd Hannaford for your excellent job that you do. Putting the ribs on the smoker and cooking
will
for the Hannaford fam.
Often defer to Sugar Fire. I'm just going to tell
fair.
You.
That's fair. Salt
especially
and smoke,
since it's,
Sugar Fire, both great.
Sugar Fire is 5 minutes from my house, so I defer to Sugar Fire.
Very convenient. Have either of you two baseball nerds heard of the social media account MLB Hall of Pretty Good?
No.
No.
You both would eat this up.
Is it a Twitter site, you said?
It's on I know, Instagram
okay.
and Twitter.
Okay.
What they do is they find the players of the past that not good enough for the Hall of Fame, but were still considered good quality baseball players.
Okay.
And what they do is they bring them to the followers of the account. They make their argument, hey, this guy, Hall of Pretty Good argument here to be considered. And then they have the fans vote on if they should enter the Hall
okay.
of Pretty Good.
So someone like Ray Lankford or somebody like
that's
that.
That's a great example. The most recent honoree voted into the MLB Hall of Pretty Good. Congratulations, David Freese, entering the Hall of Pretty Good. This was the updates as of this morning. David Freese turned down an invitation to be inducted into the Cardinals Hall of Fame, but I'd like to think he'd enjoy being in the Hall of Pretty Good. Despite the efforts of Rangers fans, Freese was sitting at 95% of the 35,000 votes. And then today, it became official that the final post, there seems to be no doubt whether or not David Freese will make the Hall of Pretty Good, but there is still some history at play
wait,
here.
Hang on a second here.
Yes.
You threw me off with he did not want to go into the Cardinals Hall of Fame.
Oh, you don't remember that?
I don't remember that.
Yeah, this yeah, happened.
Yeah, it's too
in,
much of a. He said it was an individual honor based on one event, possibly.
I think this was 2024.
Oh my God, I totally missed this.
23, 24?
Wow.
Yeah, this happened
right.
in the last several years. Well,
either I missed it or I forgot it. But maybe that comes to, now that Fred mentions that, that's interesting.
Yeah,
and I understand his perspective on that, but I still think he belongs.
And he says there were many more deserving.
Right,
and didn't want to take up spot.
I think he's also dealt with his share of just like issues, also some mental health stuff. So
oh, yeah.
I think that
I
probably was part of it as well. I still think that eventually he will get into the
okay,
Hall of Fame.
But I even interrupted you here.
No, you're
so.
Good. You're good. So basically, what I'm trying to get at is that David Freese is the latest honoree to be added into the Hall of Pretty Good, 95% of the 50,000 plus votes. So congratulations to David Freese. And apparently, I'm learning this now about the Hall of Pretty Good. If you get a certain percentage of the votes, it looks like if you get over 50,000 votes, you become a member of the Hall of Pretty Good Inner Circle. So David Freese, one of the highest honors.
Good for him.
In the Hall of Pretty Good. But it's fun because players have fun with this that know, like, I'm never going to be in the Hall of Fame. But then they'll respond and they'll, you know, say thank you to all of the voters and stuff like that. Great follow. Highly recommend for both of you because I think you guys would unlock some of the players from the past.
I think he just told us because we're old, Fred. I think that's what he meant.
Well, not even
all
like
players from
that,
the
80s. Talking about,
yeah, exactly.
I'm talking about players from when I was young that I totally forgot about. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting.
I will check it out.
A ticket search engine called SeatPick found which music genre is popular in each state. It is based on Google Trends search data. The most searched genre.
I hate these things.
Is pop. In 13 states, this includes California, Texas, Washington, Arizona, Michigan. Metal follows closely with 11 states, including Alaska. They're big metal fans in Alaska. Montana, Oklahoma, and Maine.
Yeah, Sarah Palin is a headbanger, man, let me tell you.
Soul is the third most. Soul is actually Illinois' favorite music genre. Any guesses on Missouri's favorite music genre?
Country!
Fred?
jazz.
No. Jazz.
It's blues.
Oh, that's,
but see,
that's it.
Two things about that. It's not true.
Rip it apart. Let's hear it.
Second, it's not true.
Let's hear you rip apart.
The
my...
blues playing. It's sad that, you know, the blues, we had the Blues Museum down on Wash Avenue. And they closed down, shut down.
Didn't
so
it,
yeah,
it relocated.
Deep,
right?
Rich history of the blues in Kansas City and St. Louis, but no, not the most popular form of music here.
We have officially entered the Burr month, September, October, November, December, to the delight of sisters-in-law everywhere. Who love pumpkin spice, fall leaves, costume parties, Thanksgiving dinners, Christmas festivities. But these last 4 months of the year have 30 31 days, which is difficult to keep straight for some people. A post on social media going viral currently where people are arguing that the number of months should go down to 5 with 73 days each. The months would be February, April, August, October, and December.
Okay.
You just can't make it up, can
silliness,
you?
Silliness.
Some people.
Random fact.
Random fact time. Boy, you left me with no time.
I know.
Today,
that's
Mark
what
Rubin.
I'm telling you.
Caterpillars have about 4,000 muscles in their bodies. Humans have only 650. Caterpillars.
Wow.
4,000 muscles.
That is rather interesting. But the way that they move, you know, the visuals are taking me there. That's a great random fact. I love it. I don't even think I've mentioned this. I am so excited about football kickoff tonight. Faurot Field Memorial Stadium with a brand new north end zone. Mizzou against, I think it's a high school team in Arkansas. They're favored by 55 points, but it is our first time to see Austin Simmons, the transfer from Ole Miss, be at the helm for quarterback. So I can't wait for tonight. 7 p.m. kickoff. And my dear friend, we went to J school together. He is one of the great voices on the Tigers radio network. Chris Trevino is going to join me in about an hour. So a lot of stuff happened today in the Lindsey Clancy case. Some of it a little confusing. Phil Holloway is going to join me in about 60 seconds. I want to play something from a reporter who was in the courtroom as some of this was wrapping up today. And the jury has been sent home for the day.
We all thought, the reporters thought, the jury was being pulled on a potential deadlock. They had the 12 deliberating jurors at the bench with Lindsey Clancy actually being wheeled up there to listen to all of this and take it all in. Each one was sworn in, pulled, and then they went out, and then all 18 came back in. This jury has been incredibly hard to read. I believe they are just very tired. They are very stoic. They are very serious. Everybody's exhausted. The jury's exhausted. Mm-hmm. I mean, When the judge instructed them to go back and deliberate again, there were gasps in the courtroom, audible gasps. And I'm sure the jury could hear some of it. I mean, it really has been intense and pretty unbelievable, to be honest.
So they do shut the cameras down through some of this. Phil Holloway back with us, the host of the Megyn Kelly True Crime Show. This has been quite a day. I don't even know how to sum it up because it's been a little back and forth, some guesswork at play this afternoon, and then the jury goes home.
Yeah, it was quite a day, you know. But here's the thing: I mean, this trial is like no other, right? This is going to be one of the famous trials or infamous trials in American jurisprudential history, when all said and done. But on the other hand,
right,
it's not exactly unlike, you know, a lot of other trials that I've been part of that, you know, where there's no cameras in there. You got a jury that is having a hard time following, or they're having a hard time coming up with a verdict because they can't all agree on what to do. My read on this, okay, and this is, it's definitely 11 to 1. We know that. What we don't know is what the split is. But reading the tea leaves, my prediction, I believe, my speculation is that it's 11 to 1 in favor of the defense. And let me say why. Before they can get to the question of to find her guilty of a lesser included manslaughter, or is it murder one, murder two, before they can get to those questions, they have to get past the first question, was she legally insane at the time of the killings? And on that point, the prosecutor must prove, or actually must disprove, the defense's affirmative defense, if you will, beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, the prosecutor has the burden of disproving the claims of the defense that she was mentally ill. They have to disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt. So the defense in Massachusetts, right out of the gate, gets a little shove in favor of not guilty. And so it sounds like that's what happened. It sounds like there was 11 in the jury room that were ready to say, look, maybe she is guilty, but I think the prosecutor didn't prove her guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's one that's holding out for guilty. And that person, I think, today had some kind of meltdown. And the foreperson said, look, I'm just going to send the judge a note asking for some help. And I think that's where we are.
So let me play you Kevin Reddington, because he was really pissed off when this was all going down. And I want to get your reaction to what he said to the judge.
The court has an instruction from the foreperson of that juror that's been working for a week now, saying that there's one juror who refuses to listen to the law that you've given him or her on reasonable doubt. And I suggest respectfully that the soft instruction that you gave them, saying at the sidebar, can you listen to the law as I instruct you, does not focus on the issue. It is the question is not sufficient enough. It does not allow any foundation for a motion to remove the juror who refuses to accept your instructions on the law, on reasonable doubt. And if we come back here in a half an hour with a mistrial because of a juror that has just spurned the instructions of this court, it's a shame. It's a real shame. And that's why I object to the court's ruling. I request that we have further inquiry. I request that my motion is to remove this juror that refuses to listen to your instruction on reasonable doubt.
All right, so the judge refused that, but let me go to some of the points that he was making, because, you know, essentially, to your point, it seems like Kevin Reddington also feels like this is 11-1 in his favor. Now, he would really have no real way of knowing that, right? Isn't that still kind of guesswork on his part?
Maybe, but what he said was there was one juror that was refusing to follow the judge's instructions on reasonable doubt. To me, that can only mean one thing. It can only mean that the person is... may say, look, I agree with y'all, but they didn't disprove, you know, her defense beyond a reasonable doubt, but I just can't vote not guilty because what she did is so terrible. I think there's a holdout that just doesn't want to acquit her. I'm reading into the language, but it's the instruction was about reasonable doubt. The foreperson said, the person is not following your instructions on reasonable doubt. And Reddington has been in that courtroom with these people for what, 5 or 6 weeks now?
Mm-hmm.
He knows the jurors who are leaning his way and the ones who might not be. So you combine what the note actually said or what we're told that it said with, you know, Reddington being in that courtroom with them. And trust me on this, lawyers get a sense for who's with them and who might not be. You put that together. And to me, the most reasonable conclusion is that it's 11-1 in favor of not guilty by reason of insanity.
You know, Phil, before my show today, I went back and I read all of Kevin Reddington's, I read the transcript, I didn't watch it, but I read the transcript of his closing argument. I had heard it at the time, and then read the transcript from the prosecution closing argument as well. His closing argument, and we talked about this at the time, it was just awful. It was all over the place. He had forgotten names of people. It wasn't cohesive at all. It was almost like there was a lack of preparation. And again, a lot of that may be stood out more because he had done a job, and the conventional wisdom from those people who were watching this trial every day is that the defense did a pretty good job of making their case. But man, closings were just a mess for him. So I still think this is fascinating. If we're still hinging here, that means the jury went home though, and they're going to go back tomorrow morning and deliberate, right? It's not going to be a situation where they come back right away and say, we're hung. They'll have to go back to work tomorrow, won't they?
Well, they will, but before they do that, Reddington has announced this afternoon after court was over that there's going to be some type of a hearing in the morning at 9 o'clock where the single juror is going to be, you know, questioned by the judge. And I think that's the right call. The judge has to decide, look, is this person refusing to deliberate? If they're refusing to participate in deliberations, they can be removed and have a alternate substitute in. But if the person says, no, I'm fine. I'm cooperating. I'm just following your instruction, judge. You said to hold on to my firmly held belief, mm-hmm. you know, and not to compromise my convictions. And that's what I'm doing. If that's the case, then the judge really has no choice and they can't remove that juror. The question becomes, okay, are we going to let them keep working or is this going to be a mistrial?
Right.
But you know, I agree with you on your point about closings. Reddington's was a little wandering and didn't seem to have a lot of purpose, and seemed to be a little disjointed is the right word. But the prosecutors did a better job, but they didn't do so great of a job either. This case was won or lost based on the evidence that came out in the courtroom during the course of the trial. I think the jury was kind of cemented then. Closings probably didn't sway them one way or the other very much.
So I'm a little confused on the issue of alternates. And, you know, you've been in a courtroom a lot more than me, but I always remember that jury alternates were there for the testimony. Then as soon as a jury went into deliberation, they were excused. And maybe that's a Missouri thing or something like that. But in this particular situation, do we literally have alternate jurors that are just standing by? I mean, they're not in that deliberation room, right?
No, they're not. But they're in the courthouse. They're often in a separate room. And here's the thing. If one of them has to be substituted in, the deliberations have to start all over from the beginning.
That's
and
my point.
Each state does it a little differently. I've always wondered why some states literally send them home, because they might need to be called back. The only reason I could think to send them home would be to try to save money, because they still have to be paid their daily per diem, their $25 or $30, whatever it is for the day. So they might save a few bucks by sending them home and having them be on call. But where I practice, in most of the cases I've been involved with, the judges prefer to have the alternates close by in case they need to substitute in. But they have to sit there in another room. But when court is in session, like it was today, they came back in. You notice they brought all the alternates back in. And the argument in favor of keeping them at the courthouse is so that they can come back in and watch and see everything that goes on in open court, even during the deliberation process.
You know, when I was reading those closing arguments, I also noted what the judge said to the jurors. And at one point, the judge said, about 5 weeks ago that we met like this, I indicated to you and I thank you for incredible service. And all of us mean that sincerely. You took literally more than a month out of your lives and sat here. That's simply incredible. Through some of the toughest, most gut-wrenching things that any person can be subjected to. And I indicate that sadly, juries carry this trauma with them for years. I've talked about that a little bit this week, Phil, because I can't even imagine being someone on this jury that has seen these pictures, that's heard the 911 call that the rest of us have not heard, that's, you know, listened even in the courtroom to Lindsey Clancy, you know, crying and screams in the courtroom. All these things are going to take a toll on this jury in ways that are probably a little bit unimaginable. I can't imagine being someone who's had to see all this evidence.
No, and I'm glad I didn't have to see it. The prosecutor went a long way. They made a strong point in making sure they used the gruesome pictures. They used the gruesome autopsy pictures and the crime scene pictures over the act of the killings, which was not contested. So they didn't necessarily have to do that, but they wanted to try to leverage that. So like if she's getting any sympathy from the jury, any jurors who are identifying with postpartum or things of that nature, they wanted to try to offset that with really, really horrific testimony. And it's a trial tactic, and you can draw your own opinion on whether or not they should have done that. But it's definitely something that traumatizes these jurors, and they will absolutely never forget it. And a lot of them are probably going to need counseling when this is over.
I think they will be. And it's going to also be interesting. I mean, sometimes we have cases, jurors come out and they talk a little bit, right? Sometimes they don't. So I think a lot of us, you know, and this is just this fascination we have in this country with cases like this. And I think you're right. It's going to go down as one that people will remember. What's interesting is that for the first 3 weeks, there was not a lot of attention on this case, right? But as we got closer to the end and then more people, and I think what caught people's attention is the nature of the support that Lindsey Clancy was getting from women in particular outside of the courtroom. And again, I've had empathy, Phil. You know, I missed 2 months of work because of my mental health last year. I have empathy for Lindsey Clancy having postpartum depression, but that's a long way from a psychosis that they had to prove in that courtroom. So we're going to see what happens. Thank you, as always, Phil Holloway, host of the Megyn Kelly True Crime Podcast. Have a great Labor Day weekend, Phil.
You too, my friend. And hey, you know, we may have a verdict tomorrow.
Well, we might. We may talk tomorrow. You're right about that. So we got a little breaking news here, and I'm just going to tell you that I'm confused by it. We'll see if we can get a clarification into the 5 o'clock hour. And by the way, Senator Schmidt's going to join us after Fox News. But KMOX is reporting, Michael Calhoun, that the Missouri Supreme Court just decided that the referendum petition on the new congressional maps is legal. But the new maps will be up for voter approval in November, which means the election will use the old maps, which doesn't make any sense because the primaries, using Ann Wagner as an example, in District two were based on the new map. So I'm very confused. The courts tend to do this. We'll see if we can get clarification. Maybe even Senator Schmidt will have something to say about that coming up here in a couple of minutes. I've got Stewie from Stewart's American Mortgage in the studio with me this afternoon. How are you, man? Good to see you.
It's hot out there. How you
doing? Yeah, it's hot, but you know what? It's the final days of summer. I think it's not as humid. I don't think this week is as bad as it was a few weeks ago. So.
I don't know. I looked at the weather report for the next week to 10 days,
hot.
And it looks like
yeah. 90s. But you know what? We're going to be bitching about it being too cold soon enough, right?
It is what it is.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about where rates are and what you're offering, because you still have an amazing offer for people with a discount. Now, there's two facets to this. One is on a purchase, right?
Right.
And then one's on a refi. So explain the discounted rate, because I've been talking about that a lot.
Okay, this is a very big deal. People are worried that interest rates are climbing, and they are. The Federal Reserve is actually meeting in the middle of this month. There's a 50-50 shot they may even raise interest rates. So now, mortgage rates aren't dependent on what the Federal Reserve does directly.
Right.
But it's
indirectly.
An indication. But indirectly, it'll trickle down the markets, investors, people buying mortgage-backed securities, which are bonds, and they correlate with treasuries. So this is a situation where you can imagine if they're going to go ahead and raise the interest rates, mortgage rates are going to continue to climb. And anticipating that, the market's actually reacting, that, and we're seeing a rise in interest rates. So if you're buying a house, you're saying, oh my God, am I going to have to pay 7%, 7.5%? Who knows what number I'm going to pay? Maybe I need to wait in the sidelines and just wait and see what happens and not buy the house right now. On the flip side, if interest rates do drop, and ultimately they will, you're going to be in, you know, with the crowd that's wanting to buy that particular house. All of a sudden, prices of homes are going to skyrocket because everybody wants to buy the house now.
And by the way, what you're advising is what realtors will tell you too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'll say that. So
yeah.
Buy it now, refinance
right,
later. That's
right.
Always the way to go. But people are worried about that payment because right now it's pretty high. So we came up with a solution. We're doing this probably on 90% of all our purchases, maybe even 95%. We're giving everybody a 1% discount for the first year. That means if the interest rate is 6.75%, you're going to get 5.75% for the first year. It's a great option. You save a fortune of money. We locked somebody today. They're buying a $600,000 house. The payment differential is $450 a month. That's huge.
That is huge.
So people are taking advantage of it. If interest rates do drop, you can always refinance for free with the bagel loan. That's the intention. If not, then you'll be in a situation where you're paying pretty much the market rate anyway. So this gets you into the house, lower payment today. A lot of people are getting this when they're trying to negotiate, when they're not selling their old house. Mm-hmm. They're saying, hey, I need a lower payment right now. So they're getting the lower payment when they can, and when they sell their house, they're paying down the mortgage. There are all kinds of different options, but this is a game changer. It gets you into the house, keep that payment low, under 6% very often, and you'll be way ahead of the game.
So let's talk about refis a little bit, because people need to tap into the equity of their homes, right? And sometimes they go the home equity credit line route. You don't like that at all, right?
I don't like it at all. So let's talk about a couple different scenarios. One scenario is you have a mortgage of $400,000. Your rate is 3%. You got the rate during COVID, really low, and now you need 50 grand. In that situation, and only that situation, I would consider getting a home equity line of credit. One little footnote, if you're an investor, you want to take out money, pay it down like a credit card and go up and down, that would be a good option to get a home equity line of credit as well. It's called a HELOC. Okay.
Right, right.
But if you owe $200,000 on your house and you need another $200,000, or you don't have any loan on your house and you need to take out some money to do improvements, you know, your wife wants a new kitchen, you got to consolidate debt, all the kind of ways, don't go for the line of credit. The reasons are as follows. Number one, a line of credit is an adjustable rate mortgage. It's not fixed. It's directly tied into whatever the Federal Reserve does, and it has no caps. So you can go from 7% or 10% all the way to 20% in a matter of a month or two. It's dangerous. Okay, that's the first problem. Second problem with home equity lines of credit are, people don't realize this, but there's a fixed time period that you can take the money out. And when that time period expires, you have to pay it back at an exorbitant interest rate. So you may get prime plus one, prime plus two, and then all of a sudden, 5 years from now, you're stuck. You didn't realize it expires.
That's a bad thing.
The bank's going to say, you got to pay us back at 15%. The third and final reason is, when you make payments on a home equity line, it pretty much only covers the interest.
Interest, right.
Yeah. We refinanced somebody now that had a home equity line for 5 years. The balance that they started with is the same exact balance they had now. People don't realize that.
We're going to run out of time, but you you have an option for that too, though, right? Because you're doing on the refis, if you go from FHA to conventional, you're still offering the 1% discount, right?
If you have an FHA loan, only if you have an FHA loan, you can go from a FHA to a conventional and get that 1% discount for the first year. So we're doing that 1% discount on purchases, and if you're converting from FHA to conventional.
Give your phone number out because people can get right in touch with you, right?
Absolutely.
Give the number.
Text it, 314-324-4440. You can text me. It's my personal number. It's the only phone I carry with me. Or Google the bagel loan.
Yeah, that's easy,
directly
too.
To our website.
It comes right up that way. Good to see you. Sorry I ran out of time. There's a lot of stuff going on. It's crazy hot outside, and it's crazy with the news world inside. But good to see you, Stewie. Yeah. Thanks for coming in.
Get more at 971talk.com.